Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to Lieutenant Commander Wach Roberts giving an account of HMAS Murchison in the Han River during the Korean War in 1951. It was recorded on 7th of January 1975 and duration is 1 hour and 22 minutes.
I'd like to introduce Lieutenant Commander Roberts.
Mr. President, distinguished guests, and I don't think I need to go any further than that. Those of you who read the latest bulletin, which had the description of my speech in it, Lou was carried away slightly. There was not actually a shore engagement in the Han River, and I did not lead it because it didn't happen. However, there was some fairly close inshore fighting, and I'll take the opportunity to tell you about that tonight. It is a marvellous opportunity. Normally when one starts spinning worries, one's audience gradually melts away, but to have a captive audience like this, so I can spin all the yarns I like, is really terrific. So you mustn't, I've got no intention of being inhibited by false modesty, so here we go. Just one other remark in introduction. This is no great historical document I'm presenting. This is merely some anecdotes linked together by me, and I've called it actually The Way It Was. I don't know why, that's just the way it came to my mind. I did two long tours in Korea, or two major tours in Korea, during the active part of the Korean War. The first in Murchison, a frigate, an anti-aircraft frigate, and the second in Anzac, the which was then the leader in a brand new destroyer. I did a total of 21 patrols, and as far as I know, as I told you I'd shoot a line, as far as I know, I am the only officer who did two full tours in Korea while the war was actually on. I know a number of sailors did, because some of the sailors came from the Murchison with me to the Anzac. Now in 1950, roughly a year before the Korean War started, at about the time the Korean War started, I joined Murchison, which at that time was the daily running out of Sydney, training the anti-submarine classes out of Watson. We were The Navy then, as it nearly always seems to be, was very short of hands, and although we were a fully commissioned ship with a war complement laid down at 210, I can't remember what the peace complement was, but it wouldn't have been a great deal less, maybe 160, something like that. We were running, in fact, with 60 complement altogether, officers, chiefs, petty officers and sailors, 60. We could steam overnight, but only just, and generally speaking we were a 8 to 4 job. We'd go out at 8 o'clock in the morning and be back at 4 o'clock at night with these training classes chasing submarines. Although we were an anti-aircraft frigate, we did have anti-submarine capability, obviously. Now, this went on happily Well, Murchison at that time was under the command of Lieutenant Commander Dollard, who remained there during all of my time. I was the first lieutenant, and we had a full complement of officers. And this went on happily for about 7 or 8 months. And then in April 51, out of the blue, as far as I was concerned anyway, we were detailed for service in Korea and given about 4 weeks to get ready. Now this was, I reckon without a doubt, the most hectic 4 weeks I've ever had in my life. The ship had settled down to a quiet routine with 60 blokes on board, and sailors, you who know sailors, always expand to fill the available space. So the ship was nice and comfortable, and everybody had the space of 4 sailors, you know, and they reckoned that was what they needed and they couldn't do with less. And furthermore, a great stack of lockers, for instance, all but 60 kit lockers had been landed to make more room. Well, these are ship's fittings, I think the technical term is, and you're not allowed to land these things without permission, but of course somebody had, and nobody knew where they were, and you can't imagine. Then just to make it perfect, the ship was brought up to war complement by means of a signal round the fleet saying such and such a ship provide 10 stokers, such and such provide 10 sailors, such and such provide so and so. Well, naturally, every ship in the fleet said, wacko, this is our chance to get rid of our criminals. And this is, I'm not kidding you, this is true. In those days, there was a conduct sheet in a bloke's papers, and if he'd committed a really bad crime that put him in jail or something, the crime was underlined in red. And I will guarantee not one sailor joined the ship who didn't have a conduct sheet with red ink on it. Yeah. They'd all been in jail, every one of them, for some reason or other. Anyway, this crowd of thugs gradually came on board over the 4 weeks. And there we were with the ship's company. And, one that would cause the first attendant a certain amount of worry at the thought of them. However, they seemed to be pretty decent sort of guys. And even so, we were 12 short when we sailed. We sailed without a workup from Sydney. We had no workup out of Sydney. We sailed with stores on the upper deck. Anyway, the 12 sailors we were short were provided by grabbing 12 ordinary seamen out of a recruit class. Well, they weren't called, I suppose they were called recruit classes, but they weren't called recruits in those days. These kids had 3 months in the Navy. 3 months since the day they joined, they were put in an aeroplane, flown up to Brisbane, taken out in the pilot ship, which is the same one we've got in the harbour now that the Lady Hopetown chaps look after, the John Oxley. And as we went past Brisbane, we picked them up from the pilot ship off Moreton Bay. So that gave us our full ship's company. These 12 kids, who were all 17 years old, as a matter of interest, wanting to keep them together and away from the ship's company we had, we put them all in one of the after mess decks and made it one sort of mess deck with a couple of stayed hands to look after them, and made them the after guns crew. Murchison was fitted with 2 Mark 16 twin 4-inch, one forward, one aft. The Mark 16, I reckon, is certainly the greatest mounting of its time, greatest gun of its time and type. It's a marvellous gun. As a matter of fact, our after one had been on the Australia when she was hit by a kamikaze, and still had great chunks out of part of its mechanism, but it didn't worry it much. But it was ex-old Australia, second Australia, of course. The guns crew of a Mark 16 4-inch consists of a layer and a trainer, 2 gun captains, one for each gun, and a gun control officer, that's 5, and 12 pulley-hauly blokes, the chaps who run around pushing the bullets up the spout. So there it was. Our chief bosun's mate, who you'll hear more of as I go on, a chap called Reg Farrington, an ex-RN chap trained in one of the trained in a boys, I don't know which ship it was, but one of these boys' training ships. We could easily identify it because he used to say, you'd all remember Boy Cornish, I think it was, of the Chester, who got the VC, faithful unto death. He said if he could have got his hands on Boy Cornish, he would have wrung his neck. The Germans wouldn't have had to kill him, because every time anybody did anything in the training ship, there's a big painting of Boy Cornish somewhere, and everyone would say to them, Boy Cornish never would have done that. Boy Cornish. He said, that rotten Boy Cornish, he was so sick of it. However, to get on, the chief bosun's mate was the gunnery control officer, and the two gun captains looked after these kids in the mess deck. I'm going, you'll be here till midnight the way I'm going. Right, so away we went, up to Hong Kong, where we got briefed. We didn't take over from anyone. I can't remember which ship we relieved, but we didn't see it. We got briefed in Hong Kong, and the old Brits are pretty switched on. They gave us about a week's work up off Hong Kong. We were able to shoot the guns and chase submarines, although we were pretty good at that. And of course never needed that in Korea. It was just the guns we needed. But we were enabled to work up for about a week, which any sort of knowledgeable sailor will tell you is not very long at all. Anyway, up we went, and to Cure, got ourselves all sharpened up and went off on our first patrol, keen as mustard, with Lieutenant Commander Dollard, now Commodore Dollard retired, an extremely keen, press-on, forceful kind of an officer, burning to get to grips with the enemy. Up we went, and we no sooner got on the West Coast than we broke down. So that was pretty crook, and the poor old engineer was racing around. It was the fuel pump, first one fuel pump and then the other fuel pump broke down, and we were steaming by hand. I'd never realised how much fuel was required to make a ship go, or possibly how inefficient the pumps were, or possibly how tired the sailors were, because the best speed we could make with the sailors pumping the fuel into the boilers was 4 knots. And that was sort of, any engineers here would tell you, I mean, that must have been just one burner or something. That was the best we could do. And we potted about like this for a while, and then we'd get a pump going and we'd be right, because one pump could do the job. And then it would break down again. And after about a week, we were ignominiously sent back to Sasebo to get fixed up. Well, of course, Sasebo, which was an American base, Cure couldn't help. Sasebo had lots of know-how, but they didn't have any spare parts. So we lay alongside in Sasebo for, a week or 10 days in the middle of summer, and, the Japanese summer's really sort of pretty grotty. And everybody getting more and more cheesed off, and the captain pacing around like a caged tiger, and me trying to keep him happy and keep the ship's company quiet and one thing and another. That was another bad period. However, eventually somebody put the spare parts on a Qantas aeroplane, and they came up, and we were able to put the pumps back together, and away we went. And from then on the ship worked perfectly. Then we did a patrol, I think one patrol. Then came the 24th of July, which would have been, I think, our second patrol. We're up on the West Coast. All our patrols in the Murchison were West Coast patrols. I might say here, now Korea, as you know, has got an East and a West Coast. The Yanks looked after the East Coast. The Brits looked after the West Coast. Every now and again there'd be a sort of exchange. Usually there'd be a Yank on the West Coast and one Brit on the East Coast, but normally that's the main division of command was that. Came the 24th of July, we were steaming along a part where sort of high sand dunes, I would imagine, but grass-covered sort of sand dunes, sloped down to the sea, and then beyond them you couldn't see anything until you sort of mountains in the background. In fact, one of the few bits of coast up there that's reasonably, you know, the sort of place I suppose you could have an amphibious landing if you had such thoughts. And we were pottering along there quite happily, about 3 miles out, I suppose, and noticed a couple of shell splashes, and there ashore were a couple of tanks that were having a shot at us with very much pop guns. I don't know what they had, but they weren't large guns at all. And there was a truck there too. There must have been a road, I can't remember quite. Anyway, we took to these tanks and they hightailed for the hill to get over the hill, and we hit one of them and it burned very nicely, and we hit the truck. The other tank got over the hill and we didn't see it again. So that was a bit of a, you know, a little bit of an action, which was bad luck for the chaps in the tank and the truck, but didn't worry us at all. And that was it. That's all there was to it, really. We weren't hit, they didn't get near us, but we did claim at the time that maybe we were the only ship that had ever destroyed a tank in a sort of ship tank duel. I don't know whether we were or not, but there is a point. Then the very next day I hadn't heard anything about this till it happened. I suppose the captain knew about it. We were told to go up the Han River and see if we could sort of get a reasonable kind of a place to bombard from. Basically, the Han was the front line at that time. The northern bank of the Han was held by the the Chinese communists, and the southern bank, where we got to, was just islands and so forth, but basically the southern bank was held by us. We went up in company with a frigate called Cardigan Bay, who was Captain F something, but he was the senior officer. Cardigan Bay, Morecambe Bay, and Republic of Korea frigate, which was a sister of us, as a matter of fact. Not exactly the same, but the same hull. She'd been built in America and given to the rocks. It took 48 hours or more, I suppose, to get up there. I know there was a cry in the paper that it took us 40 hours to cover 30 miles, and we got up there. Cardigan Bay went aground a couple of times. It was a very ill-charted passage. We got up there with the ship's boats out ahead sounding, basically. That's how we got there. Now, I've got a stick of any kind. Doesn't matter, I can use my finger. Just to give you an idea. These islands sort of go down here somewhere, and the mainland comes down here. All this, and this is the Han River estuary. The Han River, in fact, goes along here somewhere, you know. And the communists had this side, and we had this side, and we potted up here. And eventually we came to this great big bowl, which is about 4 miles across, and we made an anchorage there. Now, and these names were given it by us. I mean, they're obviously not Korean names. And we called, when I say us, I mean the senior officer in charge of the whole operation. We called this bit here Fork. The passage up was called Spoon. When we got to Fork, there was a little bit of opposition from, must have been over here somewhere, I suppose. Anyway, there was, we had a bit of a gun duel, I think, with somebody over here. That was sort of on the evening we arrived. Now, the fact that we arrived must have caused these fellows to, they're only small caliber stuff, or appeared to be, it must have caused these chaps to withdraw, because we didn't again get shot at while we were here. And we were given 2 months to consolidate. And in that 2 months,
the ship's boats, and there were also some Republic of Korea sort of patrol boats, things about as big as our present patrol boats, about three or four of them, and all the ship's boats, manned by our fellas, basically, except the Korean ones were driven by them, but our chaps manned them for the navigational part. They sort of potted around the estuary, making or finding these channels that a frigate could go along. And as they sort of potted around, the frigates would go out to the limits of the channel and do a bit of a shoot. Kai Song, which was the peace talks, those peace talks had already started. They went on for 2.5 years, I think. Kai Song, this was an area we weren't allowed to shoot here because we might upset the peace talks, but Yeo Nan was up here and we were allowed to shoot as much as we liked up here. So we used to go up, and gradually over the 2 months the thing was extended, or even more than this, but this is the only sort of significant bit. And they were given these names: Knife, Sickle, Paul Mall, and the bit joining Sickle and Knife was called Woolloomaloo in our honour. Now, I say this went on for, we were at it for 2 months. I don't mean Murchison particularly. The Han operations went on from the end of July to the end of January. And in that time, Murchison put in the longest time put in the longest time of any ship up the river. She put in 60 days here. And also we had the honour of not only being in the first group, but we were also the last ship when it was decided to withdraw, but I'll come to that later. So Murchison covered the whole 6 months pretty well. But we didn't even go up here every patrol. We had patrols, maybe every second patrol we would do. The patrols were about 2 weeks long, and then you'd have about a week in Sasebo or Kure, sorting yourself out, and then come back. When I say 2 weeks long, they're longer than that, I suppose. It'd be about 18 days from port to port and a week in port. Anyway, I'll talk about the other patrols and little things that happened in a moment, but I'll just make the whole of the Han River thing one for the time being. We had a lot of gunnery up there, as you can imagine, and Murchison became without a doubt the best gunnery ship I have ever been in. Her gunnery just worked. I think every other ship I've been in, there's always seems to be a hiccup. You say shoot and nothing happens, or you find that the blooming guns are trained on the beam that you where you aren't looking. You know, you say action starboard and all the guns are trained on the port side or something. It's not quite as bad as that, but Murchison was absolutely perfect. And this crowd of thugs which we'd got on board, they really sort of, I think mainly they'd been in jail because they'd been bored. And when they found that there was something worthwhile doing, they sort of got stuck into it and really enjoyed themselves. Both ashore and afloat, I might say. we had a pretty reasonable sort of defaulters list when we were in harbour. Led, I might say, almost led by Petty Officer Farrington, who was marvellous at sea but was inclined to drink a bit in harbour. And he also had lots of mates in the RN ships, and he'd always duck over to these RN ships and get full of rum at lunchtime. And then he was no damn good in the afternoon. However, it didn't worry me because he was so good otherwise. Now, I'd better start getting a bit serious about this.
While you're on the gunnery, how did the
new lads
get on in the off turret?
Marvellous. They had, I'll tell you about that in a minute. Yeah, my word. Right, now this took us through to September the 28th.
Friday, September the 28th. We happened to be up the river, and we had an American admiral, Admiral Dyer, joined us for a look around. He was the commander of the U.S. escort and blockade forces or some such thing. And he was a rear admiral, and he came to have a look around and brought a couple of pretty high-priced staff with him. And we were given the honour of taking him around the river. And we decided we'd take him up to Knife, which is here, and have a bit of a shot at the old man, and then race up round Sickle to Pall Mall and have a bit of a shot. Actually, as I say, we couldn't shoot this way, but we could always sort of have a hack at the things around here and along here as we were going, and then back. Now, where I've got the anchor, in those places you couldn't turn the ship. You had to anchor and let her swing with the tide. We always went up on a rising tide for two reasons. Well, the obvious one is if you go aground, you can get off. You've got a chance of getting off with a rising tide. The second reason was that we had, these were very tight, and we dropped the anchor, and with a rising tide it would push you around, you see, and you'd be able to come back again. Anyway, up we went, and we fired about 50 or 60 rounds from here, and then up Woolloomooloo and about here. This isn't in terribly good proportion, I might say. We started bombarding, and I suppose we were about here when we observed shell splashes in the mud ashore. There's thick mud everywhere except where this, well, not thick mud, but in high tide you can't see anything, you know, it's covered. But there's a 30-foot rise and fall, I didn't mention that. So at low tide, it is just mud except for these channels. At high tide, it looks as if you can steam anywhere, but you can only steam in the channels. Anyway, this black mud in the shore, I remember I saw a great sort of gout of mud about half a mile away, and I thought, gee, that's funny, it must be one of our mates down here having a shot and going short. And then it got a bit closer, and I thought, no, it must be somebody shooting at us, and then we started seeing the gun flashes. Well, we were under, you wouldn't call it heavy fire, I suppose. What have I said here? We're under reasonable kind of fire. We're being shot at by heavy machine guns, 0.5 machine guns, and we passed that point about 100 yards away. And we could see the fellows in the grass shooting rifles at us and so forth. And there were a few guns hidden in houses, cottages, farmhouses around the thing. You could see the flashes in the farmhouse. They must have knocked the insides out of the houses and put the guns in them. It was very nasty, but and the ship was hit quite a lot by splinters and so forth, but she didn't get any significant hits, and she was hit a lot by bullets, and there was only one casualty. There was one chap got a bullet through his arm, and the ship was not really damaged in any way. We fired, the gunnery and everything was absolutely superb. We had five Bofors, the hydraulically driven ones. I don't know if you know the ones, but driven by hydraulics. We had five Bofors and the two twin 4-inch, and everything really went well, you know. And that was that, and we came back pretty pleased with ourselves. We'd silenced most of the enemy fire. We'd, with the Bofors, we'd killed... observed a couple of Chinese hit by Bofa fire, which didn't do them any good. And so, you know, we reckon we're pretty right. And back we came. That was the Friday action. Then on the Sunday, somebody decided that it would be a good idea if we went up again. I wasn't too keen, but... Lieutenant Commander Dollard thought it was a beaut idea. You know, we'd teach these fellas a lesson. And... on the Sunday, we were prepared, much better, I don't suppose much better prepared. We couldn't be much better prepared, but we had a couple of Bren guns in our complement, so we brought those up on the bridge, and we thought they might help a bit, you know. At least it makes, if you're making enough noise yourself, you can't hear what the enemy's doing and you feel better. We gave these to a couple of what I thought were staid petty officers of, one was an ordnance artificer, they're both tiffies, I think. Anyway, chaps who didn't normally have a particularly important action station for this kind of job. And away we went. Well, we didn't go Woolloomooloo way, we went round the short way that time, which was just as well. Because as soon as, and oh, another thing, once you got into these channels, you were committed. There's no way well, I suppose we could have turned, but there's a bit of a basin here that we could turn in. I think I'm right in saying it would have been very difficult to stop anywhere and turn. You know, you just had to keep going. And as soon as we're sort of really well committed, we came under, well, what I consider pretty heavy fire. We were hit by a number of armour-piercing projectiles. We were hit by a great number of machine gun bullets, lots of splinters. We were hit by a bazooka, which is, in those days, they alleged its maximum range was 200 yards. We were missed by several mortar shells, which wouldn't have been very nice if they'd come inboard. And altogether, it was a fairly dicey run up here. We turned on our anchor, and in turning, the director, which directs the guns, was wooded because the stern went through where we wanted to fire the guns as we turned. So the director and the forward gun could not bear. And without, and anyone who's done, sort of been mixed up in gunnery here will appreciate this, without missing a beat, Petty Officer Farrington on X gun, he went into local control, and for that period of maybe, I don't know, 20, 30 rounds per gun, which might have been a minute and a half or something, for that period he was in local control, controlling it himself. We were under very heavy machine gun fire, the water was all being stirred up and so forth, and looking aft, and he had these kids, you know, and looking aft I could see him standing on an ammunition locker so he could get a good view, completely exposed, really enjoying himself, you know, and sort of giving the orders and these kids racing around and one thing and another, and the sort of extraordinary tales. One of these kids was holding a 4-inch shell, was like a damn great 303 bullet, it's all in one, you know, and he was holding, in the brass case, he was holding one ready to spring forward and poke it up the spout, and somehow a splinter, it didn't hit him, but it cut the case of the shell so much that the shell just bent up double and the cordite fell out of his feet. and he said, "What do I do with this, Chief?" And the Chief said, "Throw that bloody thing overboard, you deal." which he did, which is a pity because it would have made a good souvenir. But that's the sort of thing. At this time, now all of this happened both coming up and going back. But at the same time, all five of the Bofors were put out of action by hits on their hydraulics. So none of them worked. By about halfway back, we didn't have any Bofors at all. The 4-inch was still going strong, no trouble. It was on the way back, an armour-piercing shell finally exploded in the engine room. Those ships had reciprocating engines, and in order for the machine, the chain hoists for lifting the heavy stuff out of the engines have got two great I-beams. There's two great I-beams in the engine room. And these are very solid steel, obviously, because they've got to lift these great lumps of engine. Or they've got to support the chains that lift them. And a shell went through the ship's side, through the engine room bulkhead, going absolutely flat. I mean, we're sort of close enough for that. Through one of the I-beams, and eventually when it hit the other I-beam it exploded, and one of the splinters cut the lagging of the main steam line to one of the engines. It didn't touch the steam line. Now had it gone through the steam line, we'd have lost all power in that engine. We were at full, the engine room would have been immediately uninhabitable through steam, I imagine. Who's an engineer, right? We'd have lost all power on one engine. We were going flat out, about 18 knots, which was flat out for poor old Murch, and without a doubt we'd have swung into the bank and gone aground, and we'd have just sat there until they chopped us to pieces. There wouldn't have been anything we could have done. However, it didn't cut the main steam line, and all was well. As we came back past this point, I remember distinctly observing that the guns, which were still under control, I mean under director control, there's a thing in gunnery called convergence. If you've got a gun each end of a ship, for the shells to land in the same place, if they're on the beam, the guns are on the beam, the after gun's got to shoot a little bit forward and the forward gun's got to shoot a little bit back, if you see, or aft, if you see what I mean. In other words, they've got to shoot like that for the shells to land in the same place. But of course this is something at 5 miles range you just don't notice. It's something which is built into the system, but you just don't notice. But as we went past that point and the range came down to 100 yards, you could distinct from the bridge, you could see that the forward gun was trained aft and the after gun was trained forward, and the shells were landing just over there. You know, practically you could feel that the splinters had come back, except the gunnery people had assured me the splinters always go forward. But you know, they were. It was quite ridiculous. I've never thought I'd ever be able to see the convergence of guns, controlled guns, with the naked eye. As I say, as we came back, we lost all our bofas. I don't think anything else particularly spectacular happened. The 4-inch remained in action, doing a marvellous job, and we got to about here and the firing stopped. Still, as we turned this way, I might say the director and A gun were wooded once again from the main targets, and X gun once again slipped straight into local control without missing a beat. That's the thing that I'm sure I've never seen that happen before. Normally with local control it's about 5 minutes while everybody scratches themselves and try to work out what's happening. It's amazing what bucks people up to get shot at. Anyway, so that was that. We came back and we anchored here. I was surprised at the number of sailors who were absolutely fighting mad. I went down before we anchored, I went round the ship to sort of see what was going on, and the number of sailors who sort of came up to me and practically sort of shook me by the shoulders and said, "Why have we come away? Why don't we go back? Why don't we get those bastards?" I was saying, "Oh, I think it might be better if we stayed here." the extraordinary how sort of fighting mad they got. I was going to say about these two tippies who had the Bren guns, when we got here, when the director was wooded, one of them sort of went berserk, and he went down the back of the bridge, or he was standing at the back of the bridge where the ladder comes up. You know, there's no sort of combing or anything, no railing or anything in the way. He was standing with his Bren gun on his hip, shouting and screaming and just spraying indiscriminately. Some of the bullets that hit the X gun might have been from him. Anyway, I managed to get this weapon away from him and ask him to go down below and relax a bit, and we didn't use that Bren again. They weren't much good anyway. So there we were, back at Fork, and that was the end of our nasty little action. Oh yes, we had some casualties. We had one poor fellow called Garnet, an able seaman who was on one of the Beauforts. He was hit in the stomach and it was a really sad case because he got better, but he didn't really. It was one of these rotten things that he died about, well, 4 or 5 years later. You know, that probably would have been better if he'd been killed straight off. I saw him 2 or 3 times later. He was employed as the chaplain's yeoman at Penguin for the rest of his naval career. Sort of nice quiet number, but the poor devil, you know, he'd have a week in hospital and then 3 weeks out and so forth. He had a terrible life from then on. A couple more bullet wounds, which were nasty, but not too bad, I suppose. And, I suppose half a dozen or more nicks. One of the chaps in the engine room got a little nick in his eye, which he didn't report till next day. It obviously wasn't a shell splinter, but it must have been a bit of metal in his eye that was taken out with a magnet eventually, you know how they do. It must have been something knocked off with the explosion, knocked off the ship's structure. And that was that. That was the epic action in the hand, for what it's worth. We were the most knocked about ship in the combined Commonwealth navies at that time, during the Korean War. Admiral Scott Moncrief, who was the admiral commanding the British forces up there, he was very keen on us. Before this action he was keen on us. I never knew why quite. I don't know that we were much better than any other ship. He might have been one of these, you know, there's some Brits just like Australians for no reason at all. I think maybe because I used to get the upper deck broom down before he came on board and used to salute him and do all sorts of things, you know. So we used to, I say that because there are one or two of the RN ships which we reckon weren't quite as clean as they might be, you know. However, I won't go into that subject. And anyway, old Scott Moncrief thought we were magic, and he was all for Captain or Lieutenant Commander Dollard getting medals and goodness knows what, and all that was needed. I wrote 12 citations for the sailors, and all that was needed was for those to be forwarded, and two or three for the officers. And old Ed Dollard would have got an immediate DSO. There's not the slightest doubt about it. Poor old Scott Moncrief was begging him to send in. But Dollard said, "Oh no, we were just doing our job. I'm not going to send in any. You know, this is our job." So that was that. And I reckon I wrote one for Farrington, which I reckon would have got him the second CGM the RAN's ever had if it had gone through. I was so impressed with him, not only that, but you know, the whole thing about the fellow. So that was that. Now, if I might, what I've done for the next bit, I'm sorry to be. Tell me when to stop, Lou.
Yeah.
yes, I. I see I've written here that when we came back, and the books I've seen written about it, we claimed a victory, we beat up the communists, and I've no doubt we killed a few of them. But I, by some strange coincidence, no ship ventured beyond Fork again during the Han River occupation. It was thought to be, you know, discretion is the better part of valor. Well, let's face it, what were we achieving except sort of a show of force? And we were doing it on a tightrope, the ship only had, there was no armour in those ships, no armour, and a hit in the steering gear, a hit in the engine room, and another thing, the hedgehog, which is the anti-submarine weapon those ships had, the hedgehog lockers full of missiles, hedgehog missiles, was sitting up there on the upper deck, and a decent hit from a missile, I think we would have been history. We just would have disappeared. I've often wondered why our friends use armour-piercing ammunition, which was a great help to us, because they just went straight through the ship, clang, clang. The only one that exploded, as I say, was the one in the engine room. And whether they used it because that's all they had, it was about 3-inch. Was that 100 millimetre or something? 100 millimetre stuff. Whether they only had armour-piercing, or whether they knew that a tank was a certain size and had thick armour, and a ship is bigger, therefore it must have thicker armour, I don't know. But very fortunately they used this armour-piercing ammunition, and they cleaned up quite a bit of clothing in one of the mess decks. All the sailors were the best dressed sailors in the fleet after that claim. and the number of other fellows who had their gear in that mess deck just for the day. Anyway, so we battled on in and out of the hand, never going beyond here. The next bit of interest, or I find of interest, you mightn't, was we were up there, I don't know, December or early January it would have been, and the river didn't freeze, but it gets very, very cold up there, and there were big chunks of ice, you know, floes, not all that big, maybe more as big as that table or something, floating down the river, and it got colder and colder, and it went down, if I remember rightly, to 4 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 28 degrees below freezing. And poor old Mert, she was built in Australia for sort of Australian conditions. She was not arcticized in any shape or form. This cold sort of came on gradually, but we not only had sort of antifreeze grease in the guns, but we had to keep the guns rotating, training and elevating the whole time. There had to be a bloke sitting there just slowly, because if you left them for 5 minutes, they'd freeze solid. And eventually everything froze. The hottest place in the ship was the cool room, which is the room you keep your food in, which is the same as the inside of your fridge. Not the cold room, which is the same as the freezer bit, but the inside of your fridge. And that was the hottest place in the ship by about 30 degrees. Now, in those ships, things were a bit crude, I suppose, in those days. We kept our meat in lockers on the upper deck. We kept our eggs in lockers on the upper deck, our spuds and everything. Well, these things were just more than frozen solid. They were double frozen solid. I remember seeing chaps playing cricket with eggs, throwing eggs around the place, they're just bouncing, you know, no chance of breaking them, and we start getting a bit hungry. And in addition, everything froze. Eventually the heads froze, so you couldn't use the heads. Well, you know, all this sort of thing is a bit ridiculous. My cabin, and lots of other people, but mine in particular, because I remember it, it was totally unlined. My bunk was alongside the ship side. It just had that cork stuff on it, you know. And over the period, which went on for about a week, I suppose, the condensation built up on the inside until I reckon I had an inch or so of ice on the inside of the cabin bulkhead. And came the sort of final night. I remember all the officers slept in the wardroom, all sort of rolled up together like a pack of hogs. and that was, we had to leave the river. Well, we told the boss what was going on, you know, how we were, and we just couldn't go on anymore. But funnily enough, the wardroom was reasonably warm, not because it had a radiator, all the cabins had radiators too, but because it was lined, just decoratively, not lined for warmth, but there was a sort of plywood lining round the ship side and the wardroom, just so it looked a bit prettier for the wardroom. And this increased the habitability. I remember all the officers slept in the wardroom, all sort of rolled up together like a pack of hogs. and that was, we had to leave the river. well, we told the boss what was going on, you know, how we were, and we just couldn't go on anymore. But funnily enough, the wardroom was reasonably warm, not because it had a radiator, all the cabins had radiators too, but because it was lined, just decoratively, not lined for warmth, but there was a sort of plywood lining round the ship side in the wardroom, just so it looked a bit prettier for the wardroom. And this increased the habitability in those conditions immensely, more than you'd ever believe. Anyway, so we got out of the river on that time. I think that was the only time we left the river when we didn't have to. Then eventually, it was decided to abandon the hand, and Admiral Scott Moncrief, and it was our last patrol, that's right, at the same time, and Admiral Scott Moncrief said, "Righto, Murchison, I want to have a sort of last look at the hand, so you can take me up, we'll have a day up there, or you know, half a day up there, and then we'll go back and away you go next day." So we did, we went up there, and there hadn't been a ship up there for some time, and we went up to Fork and anchored, and I suppose we had a bit of a shoot, I can't remember now. I think we did. And everybody had a good look, and just at dusk we turned round and we came back, and I suppose we were about here, and I was looking astern through glasses. It was dark, or duskish. I was looking astern through glasses, and I reckon about half a mile astern, which was about here, I guess, I observed, I believe I observed, a very large shell splash. You know, nothing like the 3-inch that had been shooting at us. This would be 6-inch or something like that. And I couldn't find anybody else had seen it, and I reported this, you know, everybody said, "Ah, you're mad." Anyway, that was that. Nobody ever went back in the hand, but I feel that these guys had brought probably a couple of decent sized guns down, waiting for the thing to start again, and when we got here they were probably sweating off on us, coming a bit closer, and then when they realised that we'd turned around, we were going away, they thought, "Oh, damn it, or we'll have a final belt at them," and they missed. And there it was. Anyway, we just to finish off this little bit, I've got a lot more after this, but just to finish off this little bit, we left that night, and we knew that I knew that Admiral Scott Moncrief would give us a nice little signal saying, you know, have a good time when you go home and thanks for your efforts and so forth. But in fact, I brought this so I could read this. I remember when I saw this signal, I just couldn't believe my eyes, because admirals in Her Majesty's fleet are not prone to giving undue praise. You know, when they say "well done," it means very, very well done indeed. Anyway, this was the signal that Admiral Scott Moncrief gave us as we left. "I dislike the thought of continuing the war without Murchison, but I will have to accept it now as a fact. You have been a tower of strength, and your good name will always be associated with the infamous hand. No ship could have done better. For fine seamanship and steadiness under fire, you have proved yourselves beyond reproach. Good luck in all your sailings, and a happy homecoming to you all." I reckon that's the nicest signal I've ever seen from anyone. And at the same time, one of our chummy ships, we never did find out which one, slipped a signal into the system, which was to Murchison from Kim Il-sung. Was that his name? The president of North Korea, you know, the boss. Murchison from Kim Il-sung. "Goodbye, good luck, and a happy homecoming. We shall miss you as you have always missed us." I should
I should have wrapped up there. No, do you want some more? I can go on forever. Tell me when to stop. Anyway, right. Now, another one in a slightly lighter air. Old Bracegirdle. He was Commander Warwick Bracegirdle, BSC in two bars. He was Captain of Bataan. And I don't know if any of you have ever met him, a very wild bloke indeed, an inveterate talk, can't stop talking for a minute. Anyway, up he was boss of the a section of the West Coast on this particular evening, and up there we used to anchor in various places, pre-designated positions for the night. They're called night stations, and you'd sort of sit there waiting for somebody to shoot at you or something to shoot at, and the boss would tell the ships where to anchor, sort of towards dusk, and they'd do it by voice, but all the voice signals were monitored on the mainland by the enemy, so there was a little simple code that was used to sort of give ranges and bearings that came out in ABC, you know, rather than in 1, 2, 3. And this code, of course, changed every day, so that it wasn't all that easy to break, or could be broken, but couldn't be broken immediately. Anyway, one day old Braces came up on the bridge of Bataan, and there was his navigator working on the chart table, and he said, "What are you doing, pilot?" And the navigator said, "Oh, I'm just coding up the positions for night stations." And there was the chart with the night stations, everybody on it, you know. And old Bracer said, "Oh," he said, "that's all right." He said, "I'll tell him plain language." And the navigator said, "Oh, sir, you know, we can't do that. It's got to be code." "Oh, don't worry, my boy." And he grabs the TBS, you know, the talk between ships, which he was on the whole time. I reckon he would have, half his time on the bridge, he would have been yakking into this thing or something. Anyway, he picks this thing up and he calls up his force, so-and-so, this is boss, you know, with the call signs. And the force consisted of Brits, Australians, New Zealanders, and one Canadian. And away he went. He said, "Right." He said, "Now, night stations for tonight." He said, "The island of Chodo is the batting end. The island of Sokoto is the bowling end." He said, "Now, so and so will go fine leg. So and so will go square leg. So and so will go silver off. So and so mid off, and so and so cover. And I'll be umpiring square leg." And back came all these ships, delighted. All the blokes saying, "This is so-and-so, Roger, out." All except this poor old Canadian. And you could hear him sort of, his circuit open and breathing sort of. Then finally he said, "Boss, this is Canuck. Say again your last message." So he had to be given to him in shackle code. He didn't follow it at all. Just I often wonder if there's a Chinese cricketer ashore. It's not a bad way of giving a position quickly, is it? However, that's that. Now, there's another. I've headed these little tales after the cruel sea. Remember, you had the incident of this and the incident of that. The incident of this, that, and the other. The incident of the Chinese prisoner. We had an island right up north. It was sort of right on the border, and one of our jobs was to keep the islands, because all the islands off the west coast belonged to us, and the mainland belonged to the enemy. But because we had sea power, we liked to keep the islands, you know. And this island right up north, we got very attached to it because we did quite a lot of work up there, and it was a little bit embarrassing because we couldn't go up there in daylight on account of the fact it was under sort of aircraft surveillance, enemy aircraft surveillance, and secondly, at low tide it was connected to the mainland, so it wasn't really an island at all, so it was pretty obvious what was going to happen to it. Anyway, we went up there one evening, and with these high tides, there's very strong currents, as you can imagine, up there. And we anchored in our usual place off the island, and we'd been told there was an American officer who was the sort of officer commanding the island with a
very important Chinese prisoner. And he had a Korean sergeant with him, that's right. Anyway, we anchored, and sure enough, out came this boat. You know sampans, they sort of do a little job over the stern with one oar. Well, this Korean sergeant was doing this, and the poor old Chinaman was sitting in the bottom of the boat, and there was this Yanker came bounding on board. I have never seen a guy carrying so much armament. He had a rifle, he had two pistols, he had knives stuck everywhere he could have them out. And he bounded on board, and his Korean sergeant bounded on board, and we'd thrown this boat a line, and I don't know who secured the line in the boat, but no sooner had they bounded on board than the knot in the boat unraveled, and the boat with the prisoner just vanished into the darkness with the tide. Oh, a tremendous flap. This important prisoner who was going to give us so much information, there he was adrift, and drift with his cute little sampan, and, you know, he was right. Anyway, we were busy trying to haul up the anchor and one thing and another, and get round to chase him and find him, and in the distance I heard splash, 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 getting closer and closer, and sort of into our field of vision came this little Chinaman going for his life, saying, "Hey, away from me." He wasn't going to be left adrift in a boat. So we brought him on board, and I reckon, and we locked him up somewhere. I can't remember where it was now, but we couldn't keep the door locked, because the entire ship's company spent the whole night standing at the door looking at him and giving him cigarettes and lollies and sandwiches. By the time we put him ashore, he was in really bad shape. I don't think he'd had so much tucker in his life. Anyway, that was the Chinese prisoner. And interestingly enough, in that very same time, as we got underway, an aircraft sort of started bumbling around. It was absolutely dark, thank goodness. Our radar wasn't any good in the ship. I mean, it wasn't good enough to pick up just where the aircraft was. We certainly couldn't shoot at it. And this fellow sort of bumbled around, and I admired the captain on account of the fact that he went out at 5 knots. My instinct would have been to say, "Right, chief, give her the gun, let's go." with an aircraft pottering about. But of course he thought, and I didn't think of immediately, that on a night like that our wake probably would have been visible from an aircraft. But we went out at 5 knots, and this aircraft sort of still bumbling around, and I suppose we were about half a mile from our anchorage when it dropped must have been its entire bomb load, I think, in one hit. I don't know how many bombs, but there was the most gigantic woomper down in half a mile astern, roughly where we'd been. So he must have, we'd always anchored in the same place, so he must have known pretty well where to find us. And when he couldn't see us, he just dropped his bombs, hoping for the best. And you know, he was only about 10 minutes too late, I'd say. It would have been very nasty. Now we've got a this the incident of the guerrilla chief. All these things happened while we were sort of in the Han as well, you know, I mean in and out of the Han. couple of times we there was this band of guerrillas who in fact I think were bandits. But anyway, they were Korean guerrillas, they were north and south, they were all sorts of fellas. And I suppose, I don't know, about 20 strong or less. And the ships used to land, and this particular band, I suppose there are others, it was the only band I knew of, the ships would land them at night up on the coast, and these blokes would go ashore and rob a few banks or do whatever they did. And be picked up a few days later at a predetermined rendezvous. And Koreans were a most extraordinary mob. They got no... It's very hard to communicate with them or get en rapport with them on account of the fact that
they don't seem to have any human feelings. There was the case of the chap who they came back short one day.
Excuse me, sir. What the fuck? Wait a minute.
Anyway, this band went ashore. We put them ashore just before this action. As a matter of fact, we'd only been in the river a day or two, and this action happened. We put them ashore somewhere, and when we picked them up, the chief had trodden on a landmine, and they brought him back because he was the boss. And he was in really bad shape. All one side was sort of pulverized, and got him on board. And our doctor said, "Righto, you know, he looks pretty crook, but we'll have a go at him." He didn't worry about his arm or his leg, which were sort of in bits, but he put him on the table and opened him up and went through his insides, and picking little pieces out of his insides, you see. And he emptied all his insides out on a table next to him. He was thumbing through, flicking these things into a basin. They're going bing, bing. Anyway, he cleaned up all his insides as best he could, and put them back inside. Oh no, he didn't put them back inside, because then he came across his liver. I don't know much about this, but apparently your liver is pretty important, and this bloke's liver was almost in two parts. It was only joined by a tiny little bit. And when the doctor got to this, he said, "Oh, he's had it." I'd forgotten to tell you at the beginning, this old boy, he was too weak for an anaesthetic, so he was conscious while all this was going on. Well, the doctor reckoned he was too weak for an anaesthetic. "I'm not pulling your leg, this is right." And anyway, the doctor said, "He's had it, he's finished." But he put a couple of big stitches through the liver just to sort of hold it together, and put it back, and put all the rest of it back, and sewed him up. And he said, in a couple of days he'll go yellow, then he'll croak. And well, he was yellow already. but his eyes will go yellow, you know. Anyway, sure enough, his eyes did go yellow, and he was in the sick bay, in a bunk in the sick bay, when we had both of these actions. Now, any of you who've been at sea will know that ships normally were, I don't know what the modern ones are like, but normally ships were gunned to the utmost limits of their fabric. In other words, an 8-inch cruiser, when it fired a broadside, bits would drop off everywhere, and you know, plates would break. It was the absolute maximum the ship could take.
Battleships are the same.
And battleships and a little frigate firing 4-inch broadsides, everything in the ship sort of goes. And it's a well-known thing. If you've got wounded, in fact, one of my very good friends in the old Australia, he died exactly the same way. If you've got wounded fellas and you've got to go back into action, the chances are that they'll bleed to death because of the shaking up they get. Anyway, this bloke had both these actions, shaken up like anything. That didn't seem to worry him. We discovered that his wife and kids were on one of these islands. And we said, we had an interpreter, and we said, you know, we'll get you, you're a bit crook, old chap, would you like to see Mum and the kids? No. He understood, you know, he knew where he was, and he understood his wife and kids were a mile away on the island. No, he didn't want to see him. Anyway, I think we must have been a bit racist or something in those days, because when we came back after the second action with a couple of two or three wounded chaps of our own, we hollered up a helicopter. In fact, we've got two or three helicopters, you know, these hospital jobs, to race our guys off to hospital. And because the old chief was there, we put him in. There was a spare place, we sent him off, took the opportunity to get rid of him too, but we hadn't thought of sending him off to hospital before. And anyway, of course, the doctor said he was already as good as dead. But to finish the story, I don't know, 2 months, 3 months later, we happened to go into one of the ports, and there was this character on crutches, arm in a sling, one leg all done up, on the wharf to greet us, waving to us, reckoning we were the greatest blokes in the world. he'd recovered, no trouble at all. And you just can't kill them. There's one other I feel is worthwhile telling, and then I really think I could go forever, but I won't, as I said. On Christmas Eve, 1951, we were on our way back to Sasebo, and at midnight, it was blowing, at least half a gale, if not more. It was snowing hard, and as I say, our radar wasn't terribly good, and precisely at midnight, a South Korean fishing boat rammed us right at my cabin. In fact, the dent sort of shifted my bunk. If it had been steel, it probably would have shifted me. But I was in my bunk, and I couldn't imagine this terrific crash. It sounded exactly as if the gun overhead had fired, and I thought, you know, we're out of the patrol area, it's the middle of the night, it's what on earth are we firing a gun for? But it wasn't a gun, it was this fishing boat. And I got up on deck, and there was this thing flopping around about a quarter of a mile away. We had him in our lights, our signal lights, signal lanterns, and quite clearly, and as we watched him, he put his bow under and sank. So very foolishly we called away a lifeboat's crew and put it in the water, and it immediately lost, it couldn't hack it at all, so we had to get the lifeboat back. So I suppose we wasted 20 minutes before we drifted down on these survivors. And there had been 12 fellows in the boat. There were about 6 or 7 left. You can imagine what there had been 12 chaps in the fishing craft. You can imagine what the temperature of the water was. I suppose it was as low as seawater can get. And we drifted down, and by that time we had big groups of lights arranged, so we had very good light on the lee side, what was it, the starboard side we drifted down. And there were these fellas, as I say, there were 5 or 6 of them still swimming. And we got a Kali raft over the side, and Petty Officer Farrington and I went down into this Kali raft to sort of drag the blokes into it, and then there was a jumping net and there were other fellas to help them up, you see. And but of course we were drifting pretty slowly, I suppose, but anyway, and these blokes weren't exactly in the right place. Well, we got a couple out, and there was one I've never forgotten. I suppose if I was a hero I'd have gone and got him, but there was one in the light which penetrated quite deeply into the water. It was good clear water. He just stopped swimming and sank out of sight, just kept sinking. As I say, if I'd been a real hero, I'd have gone in and got him at about 10 feet, I suppose, by the time I woke up to myself, he was gone. Anyway, old Farrington suddenly jumps out of the raft and swims not far, I suppose, 20, 30 feet, that's all, and gets one of these blokes and drags him back. And when he came back into the raft, I said, that's the stupidest thing I ever saw anybody do in my life. You know, when you think of the water temperature, the gale that was running and so forth, anyone who leaves his ship with both hands, you can leave it with one, as long as you've got one hand still stuck to the ship, I reckon it's all right. And I said, don't you ever do that again. So immediately he went over the side and got another one. So anyway, we eventually got back on deck, and he was getting a bit cold by then. So I put him down in the cabin with a bottle of rum, which of course is the reason why he went into the water in the first place. he was
wasn't much use for a while. But then one of these poor devils we got on board died, and we decided to bury him at sea before we got in. The old traditional business in the hammock, and once again Farrington a flip to the fore, he sewed him up, and sure enough, I knew he'd do it, sure enough he put the last stitch through this fellow's nose in the traditional fashion. Anyway, we slipped this poor fellow over the side, and that was that. But it was a very sad sort of an incident. This was a perfectly well-found fishing boat, and he didn't see us, we didn't see him. As I say, visibility was nearly nil. And by Jiminy, it shows you how cold and how dangerous that water is. I thought I might get old Farrington some sort of life-saving medal out of that lot, but once again the captain reckoned that, you know, we just do our job, old chap. So we just do our job, and that was that. Well, now, that, as I say, I've got a heap of other tales, but I won't keep boring you. That was the end of the Murchison time. I think I've covered it fairly well. I'll just very briefly say we came back to Australia. I was drafted out of the Murchison, appointed out of the Murchison to the Anzac, which was the destroyer leader, which was brand new, with a sort of picked ship's company. And I bounded on board and said, "What's the program?" They said, "Oh, we're off to Korea, didn't you know?" So back I went in the Anzac at a much, much quieter time. For a start, the destroyer spent half their time with the carrier, so that it was just sort of sea time. Secondly, she was a brand new ship, a beautiful ship with a very keen ship's company. Thirdly, we had being the leader, we had a captain's secretary and we had a paymaster on board who looked after the canteen and things like that. Whereas in the Murchison, I had to do the canteen myself, and I was also a victualling officer. The canteen, I don't know if there's any accountants here, but I had a very smart canteen manager, I decided afterwards, because at that time, until everybody woke up to it, every time a first lieutenant of a frigate or destroyer was relieved because he was court-martialed, because the canteen accounts were all haywire. Well, when you're overseas, there's a lot of money exchange goes on, and you make quite a bit of money. And in the course of our trip away in Murchison, we made about £600, which is a lot of money in those days. 600 quid in exchange, and that exchange money, as it happened, was paid into the canteen, and I put it down as takings. I learned long afterwards that it should have gone in some other column altogether, but my canteen manager, he sort of kept my books for me, mainly, or cooked my books for me. Anyway, when the time came for takeover, I was delighted to find that everything balanced exactly. Well, of course, I realised later that somebody had got away with 600 quid. But by the time I realised, it was about 5 years later, I was talking to somebody, some accountant bloke, and he said, "Hey, that's not right." Anyway, good luck to him. He got away with it. But anyway, as I say, in the Anzac, I found I had a brand new ship. I had a keen ship's company. I had a captain who sort of had his sailors were. Well, I'm not saying they weren't keen to work for Captain Dollard, but Captain Gattaca was the captain. He was an outstanding captain in those days. And the sailors absolutely loved him. They'd do anything for him. The first lieutenant was a sort of fifth wheel. I'd use it to wander around the upper deck. I couldn't find anything wrong. We never had any defaulters. the paymasters looked after all the difficult parts. And all I needed to do was to sit at the head of the table and mess dinners. That was about the only time I did any work. And very little happened in the Anzac. As I say, nothing very much at all. I did write a couple of things, but I don't think they're worth even telling you about. I think that's all. So, if I've given you enough, yes, I'll say an hour.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.